That's just the quotes that I'll be moving through today with this talk, if we get through them all. And really what we're looking at is the word as ground. So by the word, as we discussed yesterday, we're talking about the sacred scripture, but we're also talking about truth. So the heavenly doctrine, so divine revelation, text of divine revelation is the definition of the word that I'm going to be using today. So it encompasses all of Swedenborg's published works and the sacred scripture that we find in the Bible, the word as it is found in the Bible. Now, I don't know if some of you will no doubt be aware that the word is quite a technical term. So when we talk about the word, or when the writings talk about the word, they're talking about specific books within what we have as the Bible. So there are a number of books in the Bible that are not the word in the strict sense. And so what do we mean by the word? Does anyone want to... Does anyone have any idea about what the word is within the Bible, as defined within the writings?
The first five books.
Yeah.
The Psalms, the prophets, most of the prophets.
All of the prophets.
Yeah.
But not Ecclesiastes and Words of Wisdom. And then it's the four Gospels and Revelation.
Very good. Very good.
And is it because of the eternal content that's deemed to be imposed as opposed to the historical content of the
Adams? Exactly right. So for a book to be a book of the word, it has to have what's termed a continuous internal sense that relates to the Lord's life. So that is how books of the word are identified. They have an internal meaning that relates to the Lord himself, to the Lord's life. And some books have that, and some don't.
Could you repeat the list?
Okay, so the books are, so you have the first five books of Moses, which are called the Pentateuch. That's going to challenge me, isn't it? Now, and then there is Joshua, Judges,
Samuel,
1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. What's not in it? So as far as the New Testament goes, the Gospels and the Book of Revelation.
So none of the epistles.
That doesn't mean anything to me.
Gospels in the New Testament, the four Gospels and the Book of Revelation are the word.
Are the word.
Yep. Everything else is what Swedenborg would term good books for the church, but not the word. In terms of the Old Testament, the books that aren't included are Ecclesiastes,
Proverbs,
Song of Solomon, 1st and 2nd Chronicles.
In some of the
Book of Ruth.
But all of those, like you look at the Proverbs, they've all got correspondences in, but it's not a continual correspondence meaning. I mean, they all, you know, you can read them and get but they're not.
But they don't give this consistent story of the Lord's inner life. You don't get that out of them. But they are certainly full of correspondences. For example, the Song of Solomon is... Oh, the Book of Job is another one that's not in there. So when you look at the Book of Job or Song of Solomon, I mean, there's clearly correspondential. It's clearly correspondences as the ancient church would write, but they don't have that the same quality. So those are the books of the Word. The interesting thing about this idea of the word as ground, as we discussed yesterday, is that there is a tendency to reject the sacred scriptures in our culture. You know, they have been, there's been an onslaught, in terms of discrediting those books of the Bible as being anything other than historical documents that really have no other real value other than a moral kind of value. And so even within, you know, those who are affirmatively disposed towards the sacred scripture, there is a sense of not really seeing them anything else other than something that, yes, maybe divine revelation, maybe something from God, but there's this, in the mind, there's this separation of the Word and the Lord. So the Lord is seen as something out there, if you like, or in here, and the Word is seen as something separated from Him out on, you know, in a physical book. But it's very clear that when you begin to look at references to the Word and the nature of the Word within the writings, that the very text itself is something very, very special in terms of its ability to bring and make the Lord real for us. So that's kind of the focus we're going to be taking today. We're going to look at the nature of the Word. We're going to be looking at what the writings have to say about the psychoactive aspect of the Word, of the sacred scripture. And we're going to be looking at the importance of correspondences and the idea of influx. So that's kind of what we're going to be covering off today. So that first reference is a fascinating reference. This is taken from what's called the Invitation to the New Church, which was not a published work. In fact, it was only partially, there's only a partial manuscript, because as the story goes, Swedenborg lent it to somebody who was interested, and he lost half the manuscript. So, but the principles that are laid out here are interesting. It has to do with the state of the church, and the state of the church being related directly to how it regards the Word. Now, let's just qualify something here. When I'm talking about the church, I'm not talking, as the writings are not really talking, about a natural organization. What we're talking about is a level of spiritual consciousness. So the church, first and foremost, is the spiritual beliefs and affections that you hold within your own being and life. That is how church should be defined in the first instance. If the church is not in the heart, then it's not in an organization either. Okay, so the two things go together, but it is what is internal that is most essential in terms of making a church a church. And there is direct references that talk about the fact that a church is a church in accordance with its understanding of the Word. So, you know, take that as you will. In invitation number 40, this is talking about, you can take this in a historical context, but really it goes for any of us. Okay, so aspects that come across negative here have to do with our own proprium and how our own proprium actually views divine things, because our proprium is the king or queen that sits on the throne, right? It's not into having some other being, even God, sitting alongside it, let alone being above it. So just hold this kind of more internal view as we read this. So the sole cause why the church has immersed itself in so many falsities that not a single truth is left in it, and why it is like a ship that has suffered shipwreck, of which the top of the mast only stands out, is this, that hitherto they have not approached the Lord immediately. And when he is not approached immediately, not a single truth can appear in its own light. The reason is that the Lord is the Word. That is, all divine truth in the Word, and that he alone is the light which enlightens all men. as he himself teaches, that every truth of the word shines from no other source than from the Lord alone. This light it is which is meant by the spiritual. When therefore he has not this light, there is nothing spiritual in man's understanding, but only the natural. And the natural man sees only inadvertently all things which contain the spiritual. He sees invertedly, that's what I mean. He sees only invertedly all things which contain the spiritual. He sees falsity instead of truth. While reading the word, therefore, he bends all things there to his own falsities, and thus falsifies truths, and is delighted therein. For the human natural mind is in such things as pertain to the world and to self. It is delighted solely by such things. Wherefore, unless in the above things there is spiritual light, the natural mind transfers them to those things which are of the world and of self, which he puts in the first place. He thus not only shuns spiritual things and hides them away, but he also scoffs at them afterwards. Faith is spiritual, that is, it can be called spiritual from no other source than from the truths which it contains, and thus by virtue of light from the Lord. Unless faith is from this source, it is, that should be, natural faith, which neither conjoins nor is saving. Yeah, strong medicine again, you know. But the point there is that you can see the strong focus on the word. And when Swinburne's talking about the word, he's talking about all divine truth, but he's talking about all that divine truth as it is contained in the sacred scripture. You know, you can't escape that fact when you read the writings. You know, Swedenborg talks about the fact that he has received nothing from any angel or spirit, that everything he has received is from the Lord while reading the word. So, and when you look through the Spiritual Diary, which is it's published now, but at the time, you know, it was unpublished. It was Swedenborg's personal diary of his spiritual experiences. And when you look through that, you can see that what's really happening is that as he's engaging with the word, he is then being brought into contact with societies of spirit that directly relate to what he is reading. So there has to be, yes, the Lord flows from within, but there has to be something that is able to capture that inflow and reflect it back. And what the Lord has provided in order to do that is the word itself. That is the Lord's natural, his divine natural, which is the means by which we can become conscious of his presence within us. So to the degree that that is rejected, then to that degree one is natural and will struggle to become spiritual in this sense.
David?
He went first.
Now, Swinburne uses the word falsity a lot. And would
what
he
word?
Say...
Falsity.
He uses falsities a lot.
Falsity.
Yes, that's right. And so... would he see anyone reading the word literally as having a false understanding of what is being read?
Okay, so... no one is in truths as they are in themselves. We are all in appearances of truth in accordance with where we are at. So the way we see truth is according to our state. So in that sense, we are all in falsity, but they're not necessarily falsities that are damaging, because there's an element of, to the degree that there's an element of sincerity in the pursuit of truth, then that is what makes even our falsities able to be used by the Lord to draw us to himself. So Swedenborg himself would I'm sure say that he even he was an appearances of truth, because he says that the highest angels are in appearances of truth. So yeah, so you have this question, what is truth, right? So and we'll all have, you know, we all wrestle with that, but truth, as far as I can see, really the divine truth, if you like, is the light by which we see what we see. So we see vessels that are reflected in the form, like, you know, so this, you know, this light is invisible, but we see all these objects. You know, mental light is invisible, but we have mental ideas that are the objects of the mind that we subscribe to as being the truth, right? So
I like to use the analogy of looking at a picture on a computer screen. It's pixelated, and then you can zoom in and it's still pixelated, but you see more detail. You zoom in again, it's still pixelated, but there's more detail. And so gradually you come to see more of what's behind the appearance of that picture. You get the general sense, but it's not really the ultimate exact truth yet.
Right, right. So what we see as mental objects are representations,
representations
of something that lies behind. So there's a recent example that I read in a guy called Owen Barfield. He used the idea of a rainbow. So we look out the window and we see a rainbow. But we know that, you know, a rainbow is basically droplets with light moving through it in a particular way that gives these bands of color. So a rainbow is kind of there, but it isn't. The rainbow is a representation of the relationship between that moisture, those raindrops, or the droplets, and light. And this is a similar idea, I think, to what you're saying. You know, like, it's about moving through the it's about moving through the representation, and in the knowledge that there's something that stands behind it. So all truth, you know, all statements of truth in the Arcana or wherever we're sourcing them, are representations of something that sits behind. And we can know that there is something that sits behind, but we can only know that through the representations that we hold to. But if we see the representation as the truth, then what you have is a state of literalism.
And therefore he would say it's a false understanding.
It's a false understanding. Because knowing a thing as a representation means that you're looking beyond it.
So that could be why Swedenborg uses falsity so often in contrasting it to truth.
Sure.
So it's that attitude you have to what you see and what you perceive, that it's not the ultimate reality, but it's a pointer to something
beyond.
Yeah. That's mystery.
It's like mistaking the signpost that says Los Angeles this way to the actual destination. It's not the same thing.
Mm.
But one will give you an idea of which way to look.
Yes, yes, yes.
So would it be accurate to understand then that there's never going to be a point in time when I will understand the truth? But the function of that truth is to shine a light on the appearances of truth that I may gradually understand.
Yeah, which means
to think that I'm ever going to understand truth is a complete misunderstanding.
Yeah, yeah. So what that means is that you can grow to eternity.
Yeah.
You will always be coming into a new understanding. And that, see, if you coming back to definitions again, if you think about the divine, like one of the descriptions of the divine is that it's immutable. It does not change. That's a definition of divinity. The definition of finite life is that it is constantly changing, undergoing change, undergoing transformation.
That's really close to approximations.
Yeah, which are always infinitely below the goal. So, you know, so we are always being transformed in terms of our states of understanding and our states of affection. So, and that's what gives us our life. If no change happens for us, if absolutely, you know, I don't know if you've ever done the float tank thing, where it's sensory deprivation, essentially, which is nice for a little while. But essentially, you go into a tank which has a saline solution in it. You lie in it, so you know you float very easily, and the lid comes down. It's like being in a coffin, right? And it's pitch black, and you sit in there, and there's, you know, you lose the sense of your boundaries. You know, the water is at body temperature. It's an interesting experience, but we need our senses stimulated for us to experience our life, just as our mental life, our mental faculties need to constantly be stimulated in order for us to feel we are alive and going places. You know, we don't feel delight unless there's some change in our state. That's true of a bodily level, and it's true of a mental level as well, as far as our mental body is concerned.
So that's key, that we're stimulated by change. Change is everywhere in the world we live in.
Yeah. So there has to be change in order for us to experience life.
And we're talking back to what you said yesterday, that movement in this world, change in this world relates to states, change of state, transition
right.
of states, and movement through states.
Right. Yeah.
But that's
yeah.
got to be constant.
It's got to right. be. And so it's a definition of finite life. It's that axiomatic, fundamental to us, that change has to be occurring.
And David, science is the pursuit of truth, and I think we see a lot of scientists testing their hypotheses or testing their understanding of reality, and so there's a lot of satisfaction going into this scientific pursuit. And so even though they're not they're working with appearances, in a sense, as mentioned yesterday, there's still a lot of joy in this pursuit. And so just recognising that we are dealing with relative truth is still good, because we can see that we go beyond false understandings from the past. For example, seeing the way the solar system works, there was a false idea of the Earth being the centre of the solar system. Now the sun is seen to be the centre, so that's a greater, a big improvement from past ways of understanding, and it's verified. So that's how we come to appreciate truth, because we can verify things and land a person onto the moon based on our understanding.
Okay, so, and I don't disagree with that at all, but I'm just going to bring a slightly different perspective on it. So when the world was at the centre of the universe, what that describes is actually a state of mind that I am the centre of everything. So in that sense, what the Middle Ages, their view, actually was a truth. And it's a spiritual truth, not necessarily a material or physical truth. So what you have to be aware of is that the way people in the Middle Ages thought is not the way we think. And so we make a judgment about the way they thought from where we stand, which we are interested. So science is the pursuit, not necessarily of truth, but of knowledge. Okay? So what's interesting about that, though, is that, so if you go back to the most ancient church and what we can know of them, what you find is that everything that is perceived outwardly is intuited in terms of inner mental processes that are going, processes of consciousness. There is no distinction drawn. So a similar kind of thing could be said about the way people in the Middle Ages understood things, was this uniting between the external and the internal. They were more in tune with that. So what you find after the Enlightenment is that people began to separate those things out, dropped the meaning aspect, and became interested in the objects in themselves. Not the representation became the reality for science. That's what science studies. But the meaning is philosophy, and science doesn't really go there. And that's why in science you get, you know, they have their own mythology, the Big Bang, evolution. This is a mythology. It's not an actual scientific. It's not the realm of science. What it is, it's the realm of. It falls into the realm of philosophy or
cosmology,
dogma, and storytelling, which humans cannot get away from.
Did you say all this happened after enlightenment?
The obsession with objects in themselves, because they developed the power.
Yeah, but did it happen after enlightenment?
The age of the enlightenment.
Not the 18th century.
Oh. Sorry about that. Yeah. So yeah. So just in the history of consciousness, there's that period where.
So that was 1700s.
Yeah, that's right. Swedenborg's era.
This subject we're talking about now, to me, this is explaining why we're such an unusual little group here. And out there, outside those walls, where you've got secular materialism, it's like science, the science we're talking about now that Michael started the conversation on. I can't blame people for seeing science instead of God. Because you pick up your mobile phone, it works. Hop in your car, it works. You hop in the plane, it works. Science has discovered all these profound truths, and they are absolute truths because they work. The plane flies. But the secular people out there, which we're trying to contend with, I believe, are all calling truth relative. In general, they're saying that, which is also true, everyone has their personal truth. So they're saying the truth is just relative, and it depends on what you think, what I think. We're here, so we're with an understanding through the Bible and through Swedenborg, totally opposed to this. This is what we're up against. We're up against people in society who see the incredible benefits that science has brought in since the age of enlightenment. How can we blame them? We're seeing people, the same people are saying truth is just relative, it's whatever you believe. Again, in a sense, they're right. But to me, above all that, or under what, if you want to say, we know, really, but to me, I feel we know, we're on something far, far, far more profound. But this is what we're up against.
Sure.
And I totally understand what we're up against. And yet, our truth to me, well, to me, the word is like, this is profound statements here. It says, the Lord is the Word. How would you explain that to anybody? Even in the church, let alone outside.
Well, that's right. That's the challenge. That is the challenge, isn't it? For sure.
Maybe you can explain it to us then. Well, that's what we've been doing for quite a few years. That's what we've
been doing. Could I just ask you a quick question about this age of
enlightenment?
It's called the Age of Enlightenment, and there's, I gather, there was huge explosions in art and understanding, and it was Swedenborg's time, science
mainly.
But how come, if it was the Age of Enlightenment, that it actually darkened understanding?
Because it's the Age of Enlightenment from the modern scientific point of view, not from our point of view.
Understanding the physical
world. But it was the Age of Enlightenment. Swedenborg was in that time.
Yes, so Swedenborg was the counter, and others as well. But he brought. So what happened? What eventually happened was, is that the focus became solely on truth, became what could be perceived in the senses.
But then art in that time, art was very religious. The explosion.
If you look at art,
sort of shift away from science. What happened was
more scientific in a way.
Yeah, what happened was, if you look at Middle Ages art, right? They didn't give much focus to perception. Perspective. You know, so things like you have icons, for example, they're a lot older than the Middle Ages, but you know, not in proportion, because it wasn't important. in the sense that what that art was doing was conveying meaning. When perspective came about, what was important was representing what you could see. So that became a dominant factor for a period. I mean, then it went abstract. But when you look at symbols are universal and they speak universal truths. What art became over time was personal, about how I feel. So you lost the symbolic nature of it in that spiritual universal sense. So in the Middle Ages, if you like, and this is a theory or an evaluation by Owen Barfield. This is, I'm reading this at the moment, okay? But what he talks about is the fact that what happened post-Age of the Enlightenment was that the object became the real thing. Prior to that, the meaning behind it was the real thing. And the purpose of the object was to represent that meaning and bring people into a higher awareness of things. And that that's what has been lost as we have moved more and more into studying the thing in itself. So what do you find during that Age of Enlightenment? Guys just fascinated with bugs, but just categorizing them. You know, like you just get people whose mindset was just into listing things, putting them into families and relationships. And
it's like, you know, carry a picture of God's palette around with me all the time.
You know, so and how did they do? How did they study them? They put a pin through it and stuck it into a board. So they're looking at something dead. And doesn't that tell a story, right? So, you know, so the actual engagement or the participation in what is living is being reduced, you know. And so you can see that in the way, I mean, I know there's attempts and the movement to reverse it in alternative health circles and within the mainstream health now, but people are basically treated as things. You know, because
machines, almost,
yeah, that's right. You know, it's
oilless and will work.
Yeah, you know. So it's that. So and that all comes out of this removal of the representation from the meaning.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Now, can I just say one more thing? Well, I got it on my mind because this is what has happened with the word. The exact same thing has happened with the word. The meaning and the representation has been separated out, and so the meaning has been lost, and what you're left with is a dead text for most people. And you know, what's interesting in the illustration is that, you know, Swedenborg in his search for the seed of the soul, right, if you know the story, it was, you know, anatomy, you know, so where is it, you know, the pineal gland, let's get in there and find the soul, because you're dealing with a dead thing. And even if you could have a live body in front of you, it doesn't matter how you cut it up, you're not going to find the soul. And so what biblical criticism did is that it takes the text, or it takes a scalpel to the text, seeking, is there any meaning really in this? You know, it's a dead thing. No, they go find it, because it's not in the pineal gland. It's in the lived experience of it, and that you need a living human being to be engaged with it.
So we've ended up with what appears to be a log of actual history, which is so far from applying it to our internal lives in a meaningful and instructive way.
That's right, and the other factor we've ended up with is fundamentalism, you know, or literalism. And in the words of Owen Barfield, a thing can either be literal or it can be symbolic, but it can't be both. Because if you make them both, then you have to engage with it, because the symbolism points to what is deeper. So if you believe that the word has an internal meaning, then you're going to have to be applying that meaning to the internal life, And the whole point of literalism is to escape having to do that.
So we've come full circle to Michael's question about falsities, because actually Swedenborg does say we've got to start with the outer stuff first and then gradually build the sense that there, with the not appreciation that there is an inner sense, but we don't see it yet at first. So we reread it, we go further. So it's a falsity in a way that we're being shown, but gradually the picture deepens towards the spiritual content, and what we can actually apply comes through.
Nice. In the end, right? Yeah, that's right. So, so the whole point is about application. And, you know, so you get statements here. Our, you know, and the Lord is the Word. That's a massive statement. You know, I've actually pulled out 21 pages. I'm not going to give them to you, but of where that quote occurs through the writings. Either the Lord is the Word or the Word is the Lord. That those two combinations. There is just screens of material in the writings that discuss it. But my sense of it and is that most people, even within the new church, if you like, have missed it or missed the implications of it. And that's what this is saying. To the way we, you know, the church is in falsity to the degree that it holds the, you know, in the degree that the word is dismissed as being actually the Lord, or the way the Lord grounds himself in us, grounds his presence in us, because it is from him for that specific purpose, you know. So anyway, so just a few scriptures that are worth considering in this regard. So from
David, sorry, I thought it just occurred to me that that fits in really well with what you just said. The word is the way the Lord grounds himself. And when in John's Gospel, it talks about Jesus Christ coming into this world, it said the word was made flesh. So grounding
And it continues
in our reality. Yes.
It continues to make itself flesh.
Yes, yes.
In us.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a quote from Revelation 19. And verses 11 and 13. I saw heaven open, so this is John speaking, and behold a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and his name is called the Word of God. So there's a lot of symbolism, there's a bit of symbolism in there, but the white horse is a spiritual understanding. And the, you know, that spiritual understanding, what sits upon it, is the Word of God. It rests upon it. And that this symbolism is pointing to Jesus Christ, the Lord Jesus Christ, is clear from the first chapter of, which Michael's just mentioned, the first chapter of John's Gospel, which says this. So the word here is the word logos. Okay, it's a Greek word, logos. So, logos encompasses, from Greek perspective, encompasses it all. Okay, it is, the logos is what is. Okay, so, but anyway, it says this, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth, or charitas and truth, came through Jesus Christ. So what we know from the heavenly doctrine is that the Word is the divine truth. So in the beginning was the divine truth, and the divine truth was God, and the divine truth became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, that is the internal sense, we beheld that, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, which is love. So this truth or wisdom is from love or the Father. That's what's being outlined here in the internal sense. Now, because the Lord is a divine human and came into the world, when you get down to material, physical level, how are you going to represent a divine human? How are you going to represent it?
A human being.
Yeah, it's the best representation you can get. And it doesn't occur because, you know, God's thinking, okay, you know, I could come as a cow or, you know. It doesn't work like that. The Lord became a flesh and blood human being, the embodiment of, because that is the perfect embodiment, the perfect correspondence of what that truth is in its essence. And that's why it had to present in that form. And the reason the Lord came as a male is because that is the correspondence of truth, whereas the feminine is a correspondence of the affections. And so we have to come into contact with truth as a means of moving toward what is of love. We come to the Father through Jesus Christ. Now what he's saying there, it's not about person, it's about you cannot come to what love truly is unless you're willing to work with truth. Truth is the means by which love becomes apparent, or is the means by which we come to understand what love really is. And the reason it has to come to us is truth, because it can sit in our understanding and we can make a choice about what we're going to do about that. So it's the way the Lord preserves our freedom. Okay? In the same way, you know, when Jesus is calling those disciples in the Gospels, they had a choice. They were given a choice to follow or not to follow. For us today, it's about the Word. We're given the same choice. You know, the disciples, as they grew in their understanding of Jesus Christ, would have been thinking, well, you know, there's something pretty different about this guy, right? So they're confronted, is he divine? Is he not? You know, that's the question that would have stood before them. And, you know, he says he is. He says he's the Son of God. Now, to the Jewish mind, that was one with God. And, you know, that's a huge thing to be confronted with.
I mean, they were waiting for God to come, weren't they?
The Messiah.
They were waiting for the Messiah. So it was acceptable to them. And if he turned up in Anglo-Saxon England or something and said he was God, they wouldn't have been ready to accept that because they weren't waiting for God
to come. The Jews were waiting for God. Well, they were waiting for the Messiah. Yeah. They didn't necessarily see the Messiah as God.
God. Yeah. Right.
That was the difference. So they were waiting for a Messiah who would deliver them from the Rome at that particular point.
Waiting
from the Rome.
Political power of God.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So
they were waiting for 800 years. So, you know. That's the thing. Is this the right guy? Is this the right bloke? I mean,
that question is what we are confronted with when we come before the text. Is this divine or isn't it? Mm. You know, that's the question that sits before us. And if it is, then what are the implications of that? So, you know, we often, we will read something, like say that statement. We'll read something like that. And we'll just think, well, we'll make a judgment about it. But actually, you know, the whole thing, as I in that reading that we had at the start in the devotion today, is that you cannot make that judgment from your puny rational understanding. The only way you can make that judgment is to respond and test it in your own life to see if it's true. But scientific thinking has us bringing our rational minds to the Word of God, thinking that we can make a judgment about whether this is divine or not. So the starting point really is for those disciples, as Jesus was, you know, traveling through Galilee and what have you, was, okay, I hear what's being said. I'm willing to give this a go and just see what comes, you know. Can anything good come out of Galilee? You know, it's that sort of thing. Can anything good come out of this text? So when you talk about Jesus moving around through the land of Israel, interestingly, Israel was divided into three parts. You had Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. And what the writings tell us is that that represents different aspects of our minds. Judea represents the will, Samaria represents the understanding, and Galilee represents that in life. So you can see that because Judea, like the actual, from Judah, has to do with the will, has to do with affection and praise when you go into the meaning of the word. Samaria, when you look at, you know, it's all about the woman at the well, it's all about water and things like that, which has to do with the understanding. And then Galilee is where the disciples are doing their fishing, and, you know, it's where all this activity and external life. So what you have there is a celestial aspect in Judea, a spiritual aspect in Samaria, and a natural aspect of the mind in Galilee. The center of around the center is Jerusalem, of you know, around the top part of Judea, but heading more across to Samaria a little bit. You have Jerusalem and Bethlehem and these sort of places. Now, if you hold that, then what you can see is that the movement of Jesus through those different areas actually represents the movement of the word. If he's working down in Judea, it's the affectional elements. If he's working up in Samaria, you're dealing with things of the understanding. And if he's working in Galilee, you're dealing with things of natural life, external life.
Can you just explain to me what you mean by the affections, or what's involved in this?
Affections has to do with so he talks about an affection for truth being necessary in order to acquire truth.
Is that love?
Love, sorry, yeah. It's a love for what is true.
So affection means love.
Love, yeah. So So what you'll have is and you can have a love that's slightly different in the writings, in the sense that there can be many affections tied to a love, you know. So you have a love for your children, if you like, but your affection are different with each one, that they take a different expression. So, but the affection is always tied back to the love. So there can be multiple affections tied to a love. Like the, so
you
the heart
what
is the
love.
The
quality is in each child.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's an affection slightly. Is different for the different child.
So the heart,
where they are.
The heart represents the love, and the arteries and veins and things, those structures represent the affections from them.
David, is it in Luke's Gospel that he represents the life of Jesus as a journey to Jerusalem? I think one of the Gospels represents his preaching life as a journey ultimately to Jerusalem.
Well, I haven't heard that, but certainly. I mean, the way that my understanding of the Gospels is that what you have, so there are four Gospels. The Gospel of Matthew is very much set a lot of references to the Old Testament. So Matthew is like our first understanding of spiritual things that are linked into our past experience and our processing of that. And then what happens is that, so it goes Matthew, then the next gospel is Mark. And the interesting thing about the Gospel of Mark, so the story in Matthew is where you've got Herod trying to kill all the children, and so you've got a lot of violent kind of activity happening around the time of the birth of the Lord, which corresponds to how when spiritual truths first start to make an impression on us, a lot of our selfish and natural desires and things run counter to it, and so the Lord has to take that spiritual truth and conceal it more deeply within us so that it doesn't become something that can have violence done to it. So that's the kind of the Matthew story. All the, you know, the shepherds and the angels and the Christmas story is basically the Luke story.
A lot of the women's stories are in Luke.
The affectional sort of side of things.
Heart side.
So what you see, you have that first stage in Matthew's gospel. Mark's gospel, you don't have a nativity story as such. What you have is the Lord. It kicks off with the Lord at 30 years old, around that sort of period, public ministry. So what you have, and Mark is the shortest of the gospels, and in the Greek, it is a very fast-moving gospel. And so what Mark represents is taking hold of what is in Matthew and practicing it, bringing it into life. Mark is testing it, and so you have all this activity happening. And then what comes out of that is a new understanding, which is represented by the Gospel of Luke. Luke means light bringer, essentially. So it's about new light arriving out of that practice of those things found in Matthew. So they have this...
Right, so the angels at the beginning and things.
Yeah, that's right. So, and it's much more affectionally based, the Luke Gospel. So you've gone from understanding something with Matthew, more kind of head-based, into something that's now starting to evolve into our affectional life, become something more real for us. And then John's Gospel, which is the next Gospel, is the realization that the Lord is the Word. That's what it culminates in, this realization. So you've now moved from the Lord as a historical person stuck in time somewhere to the living reality of the goods and truths being present and infleshed with us permanently for all time. And then what that understanding leads to is what you find in Revelation, that the whole mind now has to be reorganized in the light of that truth. And so John the Apostle wrote both the Gospel of John and he wrote the book of Revelation. And so Revelation is all about, it's a heap of symbolism, all about dragons and battles and plagues and all of this kind of stuff happening. Yeah, or whatever it is, but all that is that all that's happening there is that the New Jerusalem, the understanding of the spiritual sense of the word, as it begins to push its way in more and more into our natural mind, is bringing out the dragon or the locusts or whatever the plague happens to be. These are just falsities appearing and being dealt with. And the final chapters of that, or final chapter, is the descent of the New Jerusalem, the establishment of something solid and permanent that is heavenly in the natural mind. So the whole story is contained in how those books relate to one another.
Oh, that's marvellous.
We should have videotaped that.
Course on that, right?
That should be on YouTube.
I could, yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, well, it's something that, it explains a lot. And you can do that with all, I won't do it now, but you can do it with all the books of the Old Testament. They all, and this is this consistent internal sense that binds it all together, and it all describes the Lord, of course. So, we tend to think of human as shape. That's because we're natural. We think in terms of person, physical person. But in fact, what it is to be human is to, you are human to the degree that love and wisdom is integrated into your life. That's what makes you human. So a human being doesn't come into being until they're spiritually regenerate, or in the process of being spiritually regenerate.
It's almost like a computer reboot, isn't it? It's still the turning off, and then to a stopping, a death, and a reboot, so that all the information can yeah. be.
Well, you need a new operating system before the reboot.
Yeah, more than a few updates.
325 updates. Do not turn your computer off. It's complete. Okay, so maybe.
It's beautiful, Dave. Thank you.
I'm
thrilled by that.
It was worth coming just for that.
It was. Let's go.
I can remember it all.
So I do need to.
The website.
I do
just
need
that.
To.
Yeah.
Just, the nature of the word. So perhaps we just may just read and just sing out if you have a question. So this next quote is from what's called Brief Exposition. That's BE 120.6. So Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." Okay, so what does that mean spiritually?
It means you've got to go through truths to get the loves from the Lord.
Yeah. So that's what's been said. So Jesus, as the Son of God, has to do with, actually, you know, it's defined. He is the. That term, Son of Man, refers to the Word. The Lord as the Word. And Son of God refers to the Lord as love. But Jesus saying, "I am," that's the name of God, by the way. Okay, so the I am, ego am I, ego I me, is a name of God, of Jehovah. So I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to love but through truth. That's what the instruction there is. So this is from what's called a memorable relation, which is Swedenborg observing something happening in the spiritual world. So there are these spirits hanging around there that are having this experience. And it says, "When they heard these statements, they all declared with one voice and heart that the Lord's human is divine." Anyone know what that means?
It's become God.
Yep. What has?
His whole sort of representation is now.
Okay, divine. So that's at the representation level.
The natural is divine. His natural is divine.
Yeah. So the Lord's human. Human is another term for the Word. It's how the Lord is expressed in our consciousness. The Lord always appears human because the form of our mind is human.
Do you think you could speak really, really slowly?
I could. Fine.
We'll cut into the lunch break, all right?
These are profound statements.
Julian's going to be late anyway.
Just bang them right
fast enough. On the paper.
Okay, so...
It might be useful for people to know this is being recorded, an audio recording, and I'll be putting it up onto the internet. And if you wish to digest it in your own time, that will be possible.
Thank you.
But before I get access to that, I'd like to process it a little bit deeper. So you said the Word is how the Lord is
The Lord is expressed as human because we are in the human form. Our mind is in the human form. So the Lord appears according to our state of mind.
Right? So I would turn that around and say we are made human as representations of what is already divine. We are an outer expression of that divinity anyway. So,
yeah.
God made man in his image.
Yeah. There's an interesting, and we won't go into too much detail about it, but there's an interesting thought here, and one of the things with working with spiritual material is when you're reading something, you know, one thing I try to do is always go back to first principles. Now, the Lord makes us human divine. Does anyone see a contradiction arising given what we know of the nature of God?
Separation between the two.
One's,
that's certainly
one's infinite and one's not.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. There's another question about, we mentioned about a little bit earlier, about the idea of change.
Yeah,
undergoing change.
So that part of him that was human.
That
part of him that was human wasn't.
It's finite.
Wasn't really part of him.
Now, is it? Is the Lord finite?
Not now.
No.
Was he ever finite?
No.
Can God ever become finite?
No.
See, these are really interesting questions.
Mm.
You know, these are really interesting questions because what you're reading is appearances.
Yes.
It's been tailored to your level. You know, it's been tailored to our level. So, and the one way of getting a handle on this is when you think about the Lord as the Word as opposed to being a person.
Yeah.
Because the Lord making his human divine, now human, the term human means divine truth or truth. Okay? Divine means love. So you get these, remember we spoke about these two things yesterday in that diagram, now the two things are related. So he is making truth what? He's making us human divine. He's making truth.
He's conjoining love.
Love.
Truth.
This is what's going on, right?
Yeah.
This is what glorification is about.
He's hooking it up to his love.
The truth in your consciousness, in your mind, if that is to be of any value, must be transformed into love. Can't just sit as truth.
And but
as a static
to do
thing.
That, you have to do it.
So in other words, it's not really truth until it is hooked up to love. Is
yeah.
that what you're saying?
That's right.
Yeah.
So the Lord is constantly making what is of himself in you divine. He's making that truth into love. That's what he's about. That's
so
what salvation
is about.
So he's
constantly changing in us.
Yes, but it is not him in himself.
So
it's
changing.
Him as we have received him that gets transformed and changed.
Yeah.
Because we undergo change.
Mm.
And those changes are in the states of our understanding of truth and our affections. Right? So it is not the Lord that is changing. It is our relationship to him that is changing. And what happens is, if you hadn't seen that the Word is divine, hopefully with this sort of knowledge, you will pursue that and you will see the Word become divine for you.
So that's why the Lord overcame all temptations, because he couldn't, in a way, he couldn't be changed. So he had to...
It talks about in the Arcana, it talks about the Lord undergoing the most severe temptations as an infant. And you're sort of like, man, that's pretty mind-blowing. And it is true, and the statement is true, but in terms of its application for us, the reason the Lord's temptations are greatest when the Word is in its infancy in you is because we are stuck in appearances, and those appearances are so strong that in order for the Lord to penetrate us, these are his greatest temptations, getting us beyond the appearance and to what lies behind, the spiritual meaning and its application. So, you know, if you're struggling with getting into the text and finding its spiritual applications, just know that that is the Lord undergoing his greatest temptations in you all over again. So the illustration you get through the life of the Lord and how it's explained in the Arcana has an application to how the Word is operating in you. They're all one and the same thing. It's all one and the same thing. But it's about seeing those connections.
I find the circle is one of the most supreme expressions of the way the divine operates in terms of its correspondences. Because if you think about the centre of a circle when, say, a wheel is turning, the centre turns, but it doesn't move. It moves location. If we're on the periphery, we only have a component. So there is a difference in the way the divine is and we are. We have a piece of it. And the spoke of the wheel is like truth connecting us to that central hub, you know, drawing us into that central hub.
Yeah.
You know, so like I struggled for a long time to come to terms with, well, what's the difference between the Lord and us? And what's the difference between our experience and the reality of the divine? And that to me reminds me of aspects of it. It's not that it's a complete picture, of course, it's a representation of it. That sort of eternal circle is the periphery, is us in life and change. You know, there's change going on. In the centre, there's changes, but there's no actual movement. There's no change of place.
Right.
So no change of final state.
The ultimate
principle of the divine remains.
Right,
but there's still things happening. There's an activity going on to support all that periphery.
I think it's worth noting that with Swedenborg, after Swedenborg's writings, he brought these writings down, and Jung was one of the first to read them and see in them the psychological aspect. And it's like everything we're talking about, to put it, if we're going to put it, encapsulate it, we talk about Judah, Samaria, Galilee, which we read literally in the Bible, and as you just mentioned, which I've never heard before, that Judah meant celestial, well, I probably haven't met Judah in Sweden, and Samaria spiritual, and Galilee the natural. But this theme is coming up all the time. Well, it comes back to me, the overall picture of this is we've got science out there now looking at all this material stuff and dissecting it, and then we've got the relativists saying everything is, we're all just relative, our truth is just relative. But Swedenborg's writings have brought down this, what I call, its psychology. And Jung was the first, really, that I can see, to pick up this and to create a whole new subject, which didn't exist before, psychology. And like, to me, all Swedenborg's writings are trying to bring in that, this whole story. Is a psychological development of our souls. We're souls that are developing. And there's a super soul, super mind up there, which we are the exact image of, human image, but mental mind image of. And this super mind is trying to bring us up as children, little minds just developing. We start off, we're only an I am. To me, I am just simply means awareness, conscious awareness. And the super being is obviously the ultimate conscious awareness that we're living in, and he gives us as a child. We have no mind when we're born, only this conscious awareness. We've got to develop it. And all these stories and everything we're talking about is always going back to the psycho-spiritual development of we humans. We're these drops of conscious awareness of life and have to develop understanding. Words you're always using, have to develop will, and this understanding of will is all it really is, understanding will, which makes up our mind, and it's the total always coming back to the development of it. It's a psycho-spiritual development of the soul. Everything always comes back to that.
Yeah, so
it's all about the psycho-development, spiritual, and so if we got the message, and now as a people, as Swedenborgians, we're up against this scientific and relative world out there, and for me, if we've got a pinpoint to come from, it's that our message is that we are psycho-spiritual beings. I think for the world out there, you've got to use the word psychology or psyche, because they don't like the word spiritual. This is a psychological development for the human being, and it's a new science. It's actually a science.
Okay. Yeah, well, it is. Life. Yeah, so... So one way of thinking about the text is that what the text is descriptions of human states of consciousness. That's one way of thinking about the text.
The trap is with us, for us, I believe, is that we Boolean's, we are in the same position now as neuroscientists. And I've read a beautiful report recently from a man who reads all the neuroscientists and tries to make sense of it all. And he said their problem is they haven't got an overriding framework. They're discovering all these things in neuroscience, but they don't have yet
a unifying.
Yes, a unifying overriding.
And just like the psychologists.
Yeah. So
yes. Yeah.
I just want to get on to a couple of, and then we'll wrap up. But. So the psychoactive nature of the word, what Swedenborg describes when he's engaging with the word is that the word is actually bringing to consciousness internal states that exist within him. And this is the function of the word. It is there to bring us into connection in a way in which we are aware of what is happening in our inner life. So, on that point, I just want to say, make this quote. It's on page 3, and it's from True Christian Religion 272. And it says this: I have been permitted to learn through much experience that man has communication with heaven through the word. While reading the word from the first chapter of Isaiah to the last of Malachi and also the Psalms of David, and keeping my thought fixed upon the spiritual sense, a clear perception was given me that each verse communicated with some society of heaven, and thus that the whole word with the with the entire heaven. This is mind-blowing. That's a mind-blowing statement. Which showed clearly that as the Lord is the Word, heaven is also the Word, since heaven is heaven from the Lord, and the Lord, through the Word, is the all-in-all thing of heaven. You know, that's it, yeah. I won't add to it, but it's profound, right? Easy for it to just wash over the implications of it, you know. So another one on page 3 from the Doctrine of Sacred Scripture, number 64. It has been made plain to me by much experience that the spiritual angels are in the spiritual sense of the word, and the celestial angels in its celestial sense. While reading the word in its sense of the letter, it has been given me to perceive that communication was effected with the heavens, now with this society of them, now with that, and that what I understood according to the natural sense, the spiritual angels understood according to the spiritual sense, and the celestial angels according to the celestial sense. And this in an instant. So Julian was talking about this yesterday, about just our reading of the word. We bring a sense of holiness to that reading. As I have perceived this communication many thousands of times, there remains with me no doubt about it. Moreover, there are spirits beneath the heavens who abuse this communication. They recite some sayings from the sense of the letter and immediately observe and take note of the society with which communication is effective. This I have frequently seen and heard. From these things, it has been given me to know by actual experience that the word in respect to its sense of the letter, that is the sacred scriptures as we have them, is the divine medium of conjunction with the Lord and with heaven. And then there's another reference there.
Well, is he taking this thing about people who abuse it?
Yeah, well,
take note to what?
To try and attack heaven. That's what they're
interested in. That was a special note for Richard Dawkins.
Wow. Hackers. They're trying to hack into heaven.
Very good. I like that.
Yeah. The next one, AC 330. It's the Arcana Celestia. The word of the Lord is of such a nature that the historicals are in their own series, while the spiritual things of the internal sense are in theirs, so that the former may be viewed by the external man and the latter by the internal man, and that in this way there may be a correspondence between the two, namely between the external man and the internal, and this by means of the word, for the word is the union of earth and heaven, as has been frequently shown. Thus, in everyone who is in a holy state while reading the word, there is a union of his external man, which is on earth, and his internal man, which is in heaven. What a beautiful thing. The last quote here on the subject from De Verbo, a little work called De Verbo. The word is inwardly living. Consequently, that it is not dead, but alive with the man who, while reading the word, thinks holily concerning it. Moreover, everything of the word is vivified or made alive by the Lord, because with the Lord it becomes life. As the Lord also says in John, the words I speak to you, they are spirit and they are life. The life which by means of the word flows in from the Lord is the light of truth in the understanding, and the love of good in the will. This love and that light constitute together the life of heaven, which life with man is called eternal life. The Lord also teaches, God was the word, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. Okay.
David,
have you got energy for one more?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the connection between the love of good and the light of truth? Another way of saying it is, I was thinking before, truth has been described as a form of good.
Yes, so the form of
good. The form of good. So, I've been wanting to ask that question for a while, and then when I saw this, that's another way of asking, because so
ask the question again.
So how do you make sense of the statement that truth is seen as the form of good?
Okay, that's a good question. So truth is good in a form which can be seen intellectually, or can be seen with the understanding, within the understanding. So truth is light, and good is heat. The two are always together, and truth is the manifestation of good in a way that it can be perceived. Okay. By the intellect, or by through our intellect. So that doesn't mean that it's just statements. You know, if I come up and give you a hug, right, that sensation that's processed in your perception is truth, but the intent is love. So, you know, we tend to think of truth as statements, or philosophical kind of statements, but truth is anything that is just in a limited sense, right? Is anything that is processed within our conscious awareness. So that can be something that so the actual sensation belongs to truth, but it is conveying a state of affection I have for you if I come and give you a hug. So that's the relate. Was that helpful? Or?
Whereas if your intention was nasty, that'd be falsity, wouldn't it?
Falsity, and that'd probably be conveyed in a different way.
But you can always give someone a handshake and you're not meaning well.
Sure, the but politician. If you shake the hand of an angel, it'll know exactly where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But it's somewhat helpful. Now, an example that may indicate my level of understanding is, say, it's important for mothers when they have a baby to breastfeed because of all the nutrition that is found in breast milk. So that's the truth. It's and so the love, the bonding the mother has with the baby is the reason why she would breastfeed. So, well, it's an expression of her love, let's say. And so I can see that as one example of it, but this is just me taking my first step. I haven't really gone into it in too much depth, but it doesn't seem like it's straightforward, and I have to dig deeper in order to get to the what stands behind this statement.
So that's good being a motivation for bringing about truth in that way, you know, that expression, which is very often the case, that good is the vehicle or driving force or desire that brings the will that brings about the truthful thing.
There's a whole lot of dimensions to it. You know, the people that research breast milk as versus, formula. And we're doing that, they do that from a motive, from a good, a motivation to see what is best for the child. So there's good operating. Then that information is conveyed, that's that information in the form of truth, a form you can grasp. And then that truth goes in, and then you make a decision about how you're going to respond to it, and that's the good that comes from that, right? So,
but the decision that you make at the point where you're evaluating the decision, that's truth.
The you are using your own, but it's motivated by.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
So the
but
two
anything,
can't be separated.
Any love isn't a love unless it's expressed.
Yeah.
So you can't
two go together.
Love anything without expressing it. Otherwise, it isn't. It isn't really love. That's why God's always flowing out into us. So you can't separate.
Yeah, I like the word express. That's it.
Could I ask a question? Are you going on?
I will do, but you can take the question.
I'd like to know what you mean by ground.
Yeah, so it's the sacred text as the basis by which what is inflowing can have something to be reflected back. So the statements of scripture provide the ground in which influx, by which influx can be grounded in us, by which we can come into an awareness of the divine presence. That's the idea of the text as well, or the word as ground. I just wanted to do a little bit on influx and correspondence, because this has a big bearing on understanding. This has a big bearing on how we respond to things. So I'll just read this first, and it says so from True Christian Religion. It says this number 695 here. Apart from the philosophers, people nowadays in the world in which I live in the body. Interesting that he's having to make these distinctions. Unable to think and talk about any other sort of inflow or influx, is another term that's used in a different translation, than that of wine into glasses, so pouring wine into a glass, of food and drink into the stomach, of taste into the tongue, and perhaps of the inflow of air into the lungs, and so on. But if these people are told anything about the inflow from the spiritual world into the natural one, they say, let it flow in if it does. What pleasure or use is there in knowing this? Off they go, and then afterwards, on talking about what they are told about inflow, they play around with it as some people play with pebbles, running them through their fingers.
Don't get it.
Yeah, they don't get it. When a man, so the next quote there, when a man is being reformed, the general things in his natural man are disposed by the Lord into correspondence with those which are in heaven. Just hold that. And then that final quote, all things in general and in particular in man, nay, all things in general and in particular in nature, succeed one another as end, cause, and effect. And when they thus correspond to one another, they act as one. For then the end is the all in all things of the cause, and through the cause is the all in all things of the effect. As, for example, when heavenly love is the end, okay, when it's the purpose, so the term end there means purpose, when heavenly love is the end, or the end in view, the will is the cause, and the action, the effect, is what Ruth, is what we're talking about. If there is a correspondence, then heavenly love flows into the will, that's us, and the will into action, and they so act as one that by means of the correspondent, the action is, as it were, the love.
Okay. And the definition of innocence would be the clarity of that channel.
Yeah.
So the clearness of that channel without being disrupted by machinations of the mind or hiding the will.
And definition of innocence is a willingness to be led by the Lord or by the Word. Is another phrase that's used. Okay, so just going to do a... the idea of... influx generally held. Is that higher into lower? Okay. Mentioned before about coming back to first principles regarding the Lord. Okay, so here we come back to a first principle. That is the first principle, but not the one we want today. Maybe it is, I don't want to write that. Omnipresence. What does that mean?
Present everywhere.
The Lord is everywhere. Already. What does this convey?
Movement.
Yep. Movement from point A to point B. So if we're talking about influx from the Lord, this must be an appearance.
This is actually in the glass already. Yeah.
Because he's already omnipresent. What you could say is that the things of heaven itself, the whole, the fullness of heaven, is right here, right now. Mm. We just don't see it. That's the issue, right? We don't perceive it as we would like to. So, what we have, in just basic sort of terms, is that, you know, we did this diagram yesterday, but we're talking about levels of the mind, and so if we go celestial, spiritual, and natural, so that's kind of the general view, and then in the natural we have the rational, the sensual, and the corporeal levels. Just so you're aware, the actual material body is here. So when we're talking corporeal, we're talking about the feeling of our body, not the body itself. So you're talking about, and this is the mind.
So
You're talking about a level of consciousness. So as we know, the body is actually dead and receives its life from the mind or the spirit. So it's all called spirit. Now, these two levels, what's termed the celestial level of the mind and the spiritual level of the mind, or the celestial heaven and the spiritual heaven, is another term. Our consciousness is not in here. Our awareness is not here. Our awareness is at this level. So this is our level of awareness. That's where we live, internally. Now we are born outwardly focused. Here's the external world. And we believe that this is all real. That's what we come to believe. And it's there to serve us, essentially. So love's, so what's dominating here...
Sorry, can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
I don't think we're born outwardly focused. The baby isn't outwardly focused. That's what we become.
Fair enough. Yeah. But we don't become it through choice.
No.
It's the path we have to travel. So, yeah, good point. And the reason we're born in innocence, which... the innocence of infancy, what's termed the innocence of infancy, is so the Lord can implant what are called remains.
Mm.
Because if we were conscious and the loves of self and the world were active from day one, we would not receive truth and goodness into us.
Mm.
So we are protected when we're born. We're born into innocence and we just soak stuff up. And the Lord takes that and he preserves it deep within, you know, say up here somewhere. And for the most part, people who are not growing spiritually or are in a state of being on hold live from their senses, live from this sensual corporeal level of existence. They develop a rational, but it's based on conclusions drawn from this level, the appearances of the senses. So in scripture, it's called, in the heavenly doctrine, it's called the first rational. The first rational, which is described in the book of Genesis through the character of Ishmael, who's called a wild ass of a man whose hand is against all. So if you want to see what a first rational looks like, look at your teenage sons and you'll get a good idea of what the first rational is like. Some people never get out of that. They just become more proficient and sophisticated in their use of their arguments and what have you. What the Lord wants to do is... You know, so we become outwardly focused, and this is all that's real for us. You know, we've got inklings of things, you know, that come through our psychic life, you know, dreams or, you know, whole, you know, other things. Contact with people who seem to have some sort of depth, some sort of centered state of being. And so these things are all taken in by the Lord. All these good things are taken in and they're preserved by him. So that they can become available to us when the time is right. And that time is always now. But so, for example, he uses these good states as a means of grounding celestial and spiritual angelic influence to counter our selfishness, our selfish states. Okay, so that's kind of how the psychology of it works. But the one thing that the Lord has provided as ground is the Word. So what flows in, so what flows in is looking for something that can reflect back higher ideals. And that'll begin with things that we've picked up along the way in our life. But what the Lord has really provided in order to do that for us is His Word. And so He presents it as text in the external world, because we're externally focused. And so here we can start to read. Let's get through this, but anyway. We start to read things and we take them into our memory. We take them into our memory. You know, it sits there as knowledge, like every other sort of knowledge that we have. And then we read something that really strikes a chord with us, perhaps. It's just a simple illustration, but something that really strikes a chord and has meaning for us. And we think, you know, okay, so we think we're going to order our life according to the Ten Commandments. We're going to live from the Ten Commandments, but we're going to do it consciously. So what then happens is that what's provided then is something that can be reflected back into our awareness. And as we begin to practice this, we see that, you know, as watertight as our arguments for the way life is, we begin to actually see that, well, a few cracks begin to appear. And we certainly see that the attitude we bring to others who don't agree with us is probably not a good attitude to live in. And so things start to change, and what happens is that the Lord starts to build up a new rational in here, an internal, it's what's called the internal of man. And the more we practice, the more that rational gets built up. Now that rational, that new rational, is built up from our practice of the Word. And so more and more, what is of this gets pushed out, and what is of the Lord becomes more and more present in us. And He is active in us by means of the truths that we have accumulated from the Word and have put into practice in our life.
David,
so, coming to...
Just a quick one. Now, if someone tells you a truth, right, that they've picked up from the Word, and you take that into your life, that's the same thing really, isn't it?
It is. So you can hear someone state a truth, yeah. I mean, there are many avenues, but they'll be from the Word, ultimately, because the Word, as we saw, is the all of heaven, it's the all, it's everything. So what does this mean? Well, the Lord has always been present in here, but we just haven't been able to perceive Him. What the Word does is gives us the means of perceiving Him, but it's only the Word as we are willing to take it into our life. So influx is not about something coming from somewhere into us. Influx occurs when there is a correspondence between what is higher and lower. And what that means is that the correspondence or the organization of the structure makes the presence of the Lord felt and seen, and the appearance is something has flowed in. But because the Lord is omnipresent, as I said before, this has to be an appearance. So what does this mean? Well, this means we have to work. That our responsibility is that we have to work to bring the structures of our mind into alignment with what the Word teaches. There is no free ride. Everything has a price. Everything. in the sense of our experience of it, if we are to acquire it. Because we have to act freely from our own understanding. Alright, so I'll leave it there.
Could I just raise something about correspondence? I've always, it's something that I enjoy looking at, the correspondences that Swedenborg says, this means this and this means this. And now I'm going to jump to something that Dr. Grove said, that which is a spiritual truth, which is the various levels of the mind all have to correspond with each other or be in agreement with each other. And I've always sort of thought of these as two separate things. And yet there was one phrase in there, if there is correspondence, which suddenly kind of started to say, well, it's if there is this correspondence in us with something. It's hard to, I don't even quite know what I'm saying, but I always thought of the two meanings of the word correspondence, but it's actually one and the same. And it's almost like, say you meet someone, you shake your hand, and you go, and they smile at you, and you don't really mean that. Because you can tell that there isn't a correspondence between what they're physically doing and what they're thinking.
Right. Right.
So this word correspondence, I've always thought of it as a name that, Dr. Grove's and the dictionary said, this is this. But it's not, it's about us.
It's what happens between.
Yeah.
The correspondence is what is the relationship.
I thought it was a code, but it's a relationship, not a code.
That's right. Yeah. So what happens here is that when the ideas I carry align with the divine purpose, it's in correspondence.
Align.
But it's not always in a correspondence. Sometimes I slip into ideas that don't correspond. So, but the whole purpose of regeneration is to bring the natural into a correspondence with the higher. Why? So that what is celestial and spiritual can be present in the natural. And that is the new self. But until that correspondence is there, we live from, that the love of self and the world is what dominates. So those have to be brought into subjection. They're still necessary and part of the whole deal, but they don't dominate. They're not in the center. What's in the center is, when love of the neighbor is established, if you like, is another one, as the basis for our life, then love of the Lord is in it, because love of the neighbor corresponds to love of the Lord. So the two come. They are one. You're right. They're one. They're not. We separate things out intellectually, so we can get a better understanding. But we always got to remember that what we are doing is separating things out as objects in a room, so we can get a better perspective of how they relate to one another. But in the actual living relationship, they are one. Like, good and truth can be spoken about as separate things, but in reality, they're never separate. Mm-hmm. That's because they correspond. They're always one. So correspondence is about oneness, wholeness, completeness. Not about separating, but the separation of meaning and symbol is necessary so that we can bring them back
understanding. And you said a phrase earlier, truth is good that is in a form that our understanding can take in.
Receive it.
Yes, yeah, because try telling anyone what love is. But you can describe the outer effects of love, you can describe the inner effects of love, but you can't describe love.
No.
It's like describing energy. you can see what energy can do.
And the effects of it.
That's right, but to describe the essence of energy, and in a sense, energy is a correspondence of love. Gravitation. Gravitational energy is a bonding, bringing together, connecting, and love is what connects.
All right, so the next speaker is here. Is it right? I hope you're morning.
Went very well.
Can everyone grab a drink?